Well, I want to thank Scott now for introducing me to the wonderful world of Twitter polls. I love Twitter polls. They're the best.
They seem like they're right up your alley, Adam.
They're great, man.
I'm surprised you didn't introduce me to them.
Hey, you beat me to the punch. That's
amazing.
I'm really enjoying them for fantasy purposes, for which movie should I watch purposes,
There's only one teensy little issue.
Okay.
With the Twitter polls.
But only two options?
Well, okay, the that's actually a major issue. But the other is that it doesn't show up in every place. I guess people can access Twitter.
Oh,
like maybe TweetDeck or, I don't know, maybe not TweetDeck. Don't want to throw them under the bus, but somewhere, so you'll post this question that seems apropos of nothing, and you'll get all these weird responses because people can't see your two choices.
Ah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
Well, coming up on the show, Scott's going to tell you all the things he hates about TweetDeck. And we're going to go through a lot of news and notes because it is interesting stuff. Some really interesting trade rumors. I didn't realize the extremes of Todd Frazier's home road splits until I saw that he's on the trading block, according to a report. So we'll talk
about
that.
The offseason is a time of learning for you.
Yeah, I love it. It's good stuff. David Ortiz is going to retire after the season. More on that. But first, you know, we talked about this email last week. We didn't get to it. Let's get to it now. FantasyBaseball@CBSi.com. Please put baseball podcast in the subject line. From the Nuge from Chicago. He says, Dear Leon, Derek, and Anthony.
I know this one.
Really?
You know it?
No, not all of them.
Cubs all-star first baseman.
Durham.
Lee.
And Rizzo.
Yeah.
Well done.
Wow, that is good. Good for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Last year, we did our first ever auction draft. I went rather conservative with my most expensive player being Ian Desmond at $30. Yes, this was a mistake. I made up for this with solid depth throughout. I finished fourth, so I can't complain too much. However, when I looked at my team, I was surprised how many of my players were in-season free agent ads or players I traded for. When I look back at past seasons, this was true in most years. This year, I'm thinking of being a little more aggressive at the draft, knowing I will be able to add quality players off the waiver wire because I am so active. What is your auction strategy? And knowing I have a knack for picking up the Correas and Sanos of the world, would you recommend I spend my money on studs and worry about everything else later, or stick with my strategy last year of obtaining depth throughout my roster at the draft? So
I have a feeling this guy hasn't listened to any of our auction strategy podcasts in the past, which is fine, you know. New listeners, that's a good thing. Either that or he heard all the talk and just tuned it out because he wasn't playing in an auction league yet. But yes, for as long as I've been writing or discussing auctions, this is the strategy I endorse, the Stars and Scrubs strategy, for exactly that reason. There are, at least in a mixed league, there are so many breakthrough players on waivers that if you're the kind of player who's active on the waiver wire, you don't have to worry so much about those gaps that are created with the $1 and $2 players in between all the big bids. And in a way, you don't want to be handcuffed by those medium-sized bids and feel like you can't drop them and take advantage of those guys breaking through on waivers. So it really ends up being a win-win for you if you take this approach, provided it's a mixed league, because...
But not just any mixed league, though. You have to be honest with yourself about what's going to be available on waivers.
Yeah, but pretty much a standard size mixed league, 12 teams, I'm thinking.
I think even deeper, you can sometimes be surprised by what you can pick up off of waivers. I mean, that said, I think I don't adhere to that strategy quite to the degree that Scott does, but I think it's a good way to lean if you're looking at those two as, you know, your kind of polar opposite options.
But I do think you do take the completely opposite approach when you're talking about a really deep league, like an AL or an NL only league, because we've had leagues where we've done with analysts from different sites that are strictly one league or the other, league specific formats like that. And I used to take a very similar approach to the one in mixed leagues, and I struggled with those every year. There's no waiver wire, so you can't fill in the gaps that way. And so this year I took a completely opposite approach. I made a conscious effort not to spend $30 on any one player in either of those leagues.
What was the format
for
this?
And I won both of them.
What was the format for this, Scott?
What was that?
What format was this?
AL and NL only.
Okay.
Roto auctions.
Okay. Yeah, for the mixed leagues, I think Stars and Scrubs is just a simplified way of saying it. I think it's a little bit too simplified. I'm kind of with Al. I don't take as much of a Stars versus Scrubsy approach. But I think actually my strategy boils down to hitters versus pitchers and not spending that much on pitching and spending a lot of my budget on hitting. And whether that ends up being Stars and Scrubs or more balance throughout the hitters, that, you know, I probably want at least two studs, but probably not more than that. Like a $260 budget, I'm not spending more than $30 on more than two players. I would say I probably have two players who are in the $30 to $35 range. Or let's say two first round picks.
Mm.
And then I never spend more than like $15 or $16 on any pitcher.
See, and then I probably have four, and then maybe five if there weren't any $40 players in there.
Yeah,
I don't know.
One of them might be a pitcher. I kind of changed that up a little this year, and it worked out for me in our one mixed league auction. So as a general rule, I don't spend more than like $60 on my whole pitching staff, 60 of the 260, but one of them might be a true ace.
Do you find there's, you know, risk involved? I mean, there's risk involved with any strategy, but, you know, I do tend to go more sort of towards a value approach, which is I'm not really looking to target X number of players, $30 and over, or X number in the mid range. But just try to be disciplined with my bidding so that I don't go too far above and beyond, the value that I think that a player will have. What I worry is that if I had four or five 30-plus players and something didn't work out with one or two of them, that maybe I wouldn't have enough depth. And again, if you have faith in waivers or the FAB process, you know, you could bail yourself out that way. But I think there's a balance to be struck here because I've had seasons where I've really needed a closer, I really needed somebody at a particular position. And week after week, either there wasn't really somebody adequate or I just kept falling short in bids.
The only time I really concern myself over what I think players, quote unquote, should go for is in the planning stage. And, you know, just having some idea of what I think they'll be going for so I can kind of anticipate what I want to do in the auction on a more specific level. And then during the auction, you know, if I have a set of auction values ahead in front of me and I see players are consistently going for more than that, it alerts me to the fact that there's going to be less money left on the table later. So these guys that I thought were going to go for $15, let's say, may actually go for $7 or $8. But that doesn't mean I'm necessarily not going to be one of the ones who spends on a player I really want if I really think he can set me apart in some way. So, you know, I tend to emphasize those players who are kind of a tier unto themselves, which are obviously the Paul Goldschmidts and Mike Trouts of the world, but then also like Jose Altuve, Carlos Correa, I was going to say Josh Donaldson, but maybe not him. Maybe one of the top four third basemen, though. Those guys who I think that going the extra dollar or five is really going to make a difference in what the final output of my team looks like.
Yeah. Well, the important thing is be active on waivers and make sure you know what kind of talent's going to be available for you. And for me, and the reason why I say I spend a lot more on hitting is because I know in those standard mixed leagues, those deep roto, you know, fairly deep roto leagues, at least compared to a points league. I won't say deep. Standard mixed league roto league, which is, you know, by its nature, fairly deep. The pitching is what's most plentiful on waivers. So just spend your money in the areas that you won't be able to fill in, throughout the season with pickups and don't spend big on pitching because you should be able to fill that in. That's my two cents and probably one of my favorite topics to talk about. Just love talking about auctions.
Yeah.
If you haven't tried one.
A lot of layers in those auctions.
Definitely.
It's not a straightforward picking the best players sort of thing.
Definitely. And if you haven't tried one, you know, it's intimidating. I definitely was like scared when I first did my auction, my first auction a few years ago. And now they are the best, and so is fab bidding for that matter.
My stomach's all tied up in knots when I'm doing them.
Auctions?
Yeah.
I can't stand my football leagues right now where I'm losing to these crappy teams that have like Jeremy Langford and Darren McFadden. And, you know, it's just like, I hate waivers. I can't do all my leagues as fab because it's just so time consuming, I think. And for the novice or the less enthused player, it's kind of a turnoff, but it's so much better. Free agent acquisition budget is so much better than waiver wire pickup.
It's fun if your home league has that.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Al. Al, tell me about the Twitter polls this week.
All right. Well, I have a couple. And the first, which was last week, so those final results are in, I put a question out. Who would you rather have in 2016, Joey Batts or AJ Pollock? And Scott's going to have to remind me because this came out of a discussion we had. I think, Scott, you moved Pollock ahead of Bautista in your rankings.
I did. In both formats. I was kind of doing a mock draft with myself and coming up with my top 300.
Nerd!
Well,
sorry.
I think it makes... In the past, I've just always done a top 300 ranking players in the order I prefer them, you know, irrelevant of anything. And
right.
I think this is going to make for a more accurate top 300. But this is very early in the top 300, obviously, and I decided I like Pollock more than Bautista just because I have no doubts about what he did last year, and he's much younger than Bautista, so it seems like he's more likely to do it again.
So, and I found that very surprising at first, and I did my own sort of revisitation on that, which I'll talk about in a second. But the interesting thing in the results is it was 50-50.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Dead even.
Because I would have guessed Bautista would have won, maybe, in the 55-60% range. So more people are on board with what Scott concluded. And when I took a closer look, I moved Bautista behind Pollock in my roto rankings, but not my points rankings. And that has to do with this discovery that I recently made with guys who tend to have extreme BABIPs hitters. Are really sort of disproportionately rewarded or penalized in roto based on their BABIPs. And Bautista being the kind of fly ball pull hitter that he is, you can pretty much count on him being well below average in BABIP. And that's enough of a difference maker for me to put him behind Pollock in that format.
Just to kind of put two and two together, because I'm trying to interpret that on the fly myself. When you say players with extreme BABIPs, on the high end or the low end?
Right. So an AJ Pollock who looks like somebody who could year after year, hit maybe 340, 330, 340 on balls in play, that's going to benefit him even more in roto than in a points league where strikeouts are a bigger factor.
Now are you saying that because a player's BABIP you feel like you can rely on them repeating from year to year more so than batting average itself? So
not at all. It's just a question of how does the player build the batting average, and if strikeouts play a big role, either a high strikeout rate or a low strikeout rate, that's going to affect their points league value.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's somebody like Bautista who's going to have probably a lowish batting average, but not necessarily because of strikeouts, so he's not going to be penalized that much in a points league.
Mm-hmm.
But he's going to feel it in a roto league where batting average is one category out of five, just because you could be pretty sure his BABIP is going to be well below 300.
Okay, interesting. So
batting average, you can figure he's not going to help you that much in batting average, but it's not going to hurt him as much in a points league because he's not an extreme strikeout guy, Bautista.
What is another Twitter poll that we're looking at?
All right. So, yeah, it was quite the...
Yeah, it's a good one. It's a blockbuster one.
Yeah, all right. So today I put one out there. I was working on my breakouts column, and I really, really... Actually, all 12 guys that I have in the breakouts column, I'm really excited about this year. And the last one in the draft was Anthony Desclafani. And he really came on as a strikeout pitcher late in the season and also as a control pitcher. And I looked at his ratios in terms of strikeouts, walks, home runs, and said, these numbers sort of look familiar. and it looked a lot like Michael Pineda's ratios. And they're roughly the same age. Desclafani's a little bit younger. They have a very similar arsenal. And I thought, well, people, I bet, don't really equate Pineda with Desclafani. So I decided to see what the perception was with the Twitter poll. And it's still out there, but I think we've got enough.
Oh, man, this is going to be like an 80-20.
Pretty much, yeah. In fact, right now, it's 85-15.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And so, and there's 123 votes. So that's, you know, it's probably not going to be a whole lot more than that. But, so yeah, 85 to 15 in favor of Pineda. And granted, this is just the last 2 months of Desclafani's season. But for those 2 months, his profile looked an awful lot like Pineda's, but he's a little bit younger and a whole lot healthier.
Yeah, but he's got an ERA of 5.11 at home. He's got to get out of that ballpark.
Right, but again, that was part of the thing that made me think of Pineda.
Yeah?
Same problem.
Okay, I wasn't aware Pineda had such dramatic splits.
Yeah.
In Desclafani's case, the strikeout and walk ratio, they may have been up to Pineda standards those last 2 months, but it translated to a 4.59 ERA, which
I think
maybe means he's a sleeper. It maybe does, because people are going to overlook the underlying numbers for the main ones, but I don't think you can even talk about them being in. I don't even think they're in the same discussion in terms of where you draft them. Maybe in terms of what they end up doing, but not where you draft them. I mean, Pineda, I have concerns about Pineda's health based on the way he finished last season, but we all know we all know he's capable of top 20 production. And if he did it this year, it wouldn't be a surprise. If Desclafani was even a top 40 producer this year, it would probably be a mild surprise.
Well, I think this tells us something. And first of all, I'm not going to disagree with your premise, because yeah, there's no way I'm drafting Desclafani at the point where Pineda is likely to be drafted, but I'm also probably never going to get Pineda this year because I'm really worried about him health-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the calculation, too. That's why, in a way, I think if you look at them, sure, there's the risk that Desclafani, maybe those 2 months are a complete fluke, but maybe they're not. And Pineda may never reach that level because, you know, he's hurt or has Tommy John surgery or who knows what. So I probably won't draft Pineda, but I know I won't need to reach for Desclafani, and when I do get him, probably, you know, with the last pick, I might wind up with somebody who actually winds up being as good or better than Pineda.
Yeah, well, Pineda is potentially overrated. Everybody knows the potential and the upside, but he had a 4.37 ERA last year. He was terrible after the All-Star break, and watching him a lot, he's not a pitcher. It's like, okay, if he goes out there without his best stuff, he gets killed. He doesn't know how to navigate his way through a game with inferior stuff. Now, he could learn that. They have got a good pitching coach who's done some really good things in Larry Rothschild, but Pineda is either not a finished product or totally overrated.
Or he was hurt, which I think is what Al and I were both suggesting.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't know if it's just that he's hurt. It's his inability. And I'm not making this up. I mean, this is what I've heard the broadcasters on the Yes Network, I believe David Cohn was the one who harps on this the most. His inability to get through a game when he doesn't have, especially his best slider, he just can't do it. And he's, you know, that hurts his value, because sometimes he's amazing and sometimes he's just horrible.
Well, but the thing is, maybe he didn't have his best slider nearly as often last year because he was hurt.
Maybe.
You look at 2014, he made 13 starts and had a 1.89 ERA. That's not a small number of starts there. I don't think we should really be questioning Pineda's upside.
No, downside, not his upside. His consistency.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah, I know. Was there another Twitter poll, Al?
That's all I had.
That's all. Okay, let's go. We got some good notes today. Good stuff. Boston got Craig Kimbrell from the Padres for 4 prospects. Well, why don't you guys tell me what you think the biggest trade or rumor or whatever in fantasy right now is?
I mean, the buzz today is about Jose Fernandez.
Fernandez. Let's look at those home road splits for Jose Fernandez. Greatest pitcher of all time at home. He is 17-0 with a 1.40 ERA and 5-9 with a 3.78 ERA on the road. What is that concerning for anybody?
No, not really. you know, I think they're both sort of fluky in a way. But you know, the fact that, 17-0 at home and, you know, Marlins Park, they're going to bring the fences in. So, there's probably going to be some narrowing of that anyway, but I just, yeah, it's hard for me to think that he's not a great pitcher on the road.
Mm-hmm. So, I agree.
Okay.
And, so there's been conflicting stories about, whether or not, the Marlins kind of set the stage for him to be dealt this offseason by saying they offered him a multi-year deal that he rejected and, you know, kind of just, creating a, you know, premise to put him out on the trade market. But there's reports that, that they're not shopping him around at all. But, you know, these are the Marlins and it wouldn't be unthinkable.
You know,
that this is happening.
John Heyman wrote a very interesting story about the Marlins and how owners are very frustrated with them that they're such a low revenue team and they get a lot of money from the league through revenue sharing. But Heyman said that Loria, the owner of the Marlins, has actually been losing money and like covering costs, I think, the last few years. He's kind of trying. They just have a horrible fan base and a terrible TV deal.
Yeah.
So I was kind of interested. I don't think that their owner has been as cheap as the outside perspective might think just over the last couple of years. Before that, yeah, I mean, reputation well deserved. But I thought it was interesting. They draw fans once every five games. And if they trade Jose Fernandez, it's going to be zero.
Pretty much. It's going to be ugly.
Yeah. Sorry, Scott. Did I cut you off on this?
No, you didn't. You didn't. Okay. I was just going to say that the TV deals are something that are really starting to have an impact in the way a lot of teams operate because the TV money exploded just very recently here, and teams that were locked into long-term deals before that happened are you know, really behind in the revenue area. Mm-hmm. The Braves being one of them, that's at least that's what I heard was the main reason they're making this move to a new stadium that a lot of people didn't understand because, well, it'll be their own stadium now. They won't have to pay to play there.
Yeah, so that's nice.
Make more money that way.
All right, so we also have Todd Frazier. Now, let's stick on him because I didn't realize, but his home road splits are insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't even go through the numbers, but just looking back at the last 3 years, much better at home. So if he goes to even a neutral park, is that a big downgrade for Todd Frazier?
I think it is. No, you're right. Absolutely. Those splits are pretty dramatic. And I do worry that, if he went to a neutral, much less a pitcher friendly park, that, he'd be sort of middle of the road, among third basemen because power's, you know, you're not drafting Todd Frazier for the batting average. So
let's say Todd Frazier played in Seattle and he was the DH and he was third base eligible. Would you rather have Kyle Seager or Todd Frazier?
I probably Frazier, but that's a great comparison because I think that's pretty much the neighborhood for me that Frazier would fall into.
And you know what I would say? I would rather have Frazier and then at the All-Star break, I will trade him for Seager. And you could have Frazier's second half. Scott, what did you think of the Angelton Simmons trade? The Angels get Simmons and a catcher for Ibar and some minor league pitchers.
I saw your Facebook rant on it, Scott. Oh yeah.
And I liked it quite a bit.
Oh, well, I mean, if you want me to put this in terms of Mr. Braves fan or really just baseball fan,
it was
I
interesting.
Think it's just the logical next step in the Braves rebuilding process. Angelton Simmons is already 26, which is in shortstop years closer to 28 or 29 probably, because by the time these guys turn 30, most of them aren't, I shouldn't say most of them, but a large number of them aren't even viable starters anymore. And in Simmons' case specifically, since all his value is tied to defense, particularly for middle infielders, it can fade very quickly, and his contract is backloaded, so he could become untradeable here in the not too distant future. And instead, the Braves got, in Sean Newcomb, the best prospect of any of the ones they've acquired in any of these deals they've made the last two seasons for him. So I thought it made sense from that angle. I think the Braves are on their way to becoming, in 3 or 4 years, what the Cubs and Astros are now. And in the meantime, it's going to be a lot of losing for them, and maybe some other parts on their way out. Maybe Shelby Miller at some point gets traded, though not right now.
I mean, there's rumors about Freddie Freeman.
And, yeah, there's been rumors about Freeman, and they've shot them down. And I would be surprised if they traded Freeman, not that I think it would be right or wrong. It just depends what they got back. But, yeah, anyone probably is on the table between now and 2018, 2019, I would think.
Well, is there any fantasy impact in this deal?
Not much. I think the biggest is that Simmons, being the elite defender he is, could maybe help some of the Angels' pitchers. And immediately Garrett Richards jumps to mind because he's such an extreme ground ball pitcher. But his BABIP was already so low last year with Eric Ibar behind him. You know, giving up hits wasn't his problem. He wasn't missing enough bats. So I don't know that there's going to be a real noticeable change in his numbers.
Yeah, no, I agree with Scott there, and Richards was the guy that I kind of went immediately to after learning of the trade. But it was sort of surprising to me that the Braves actually, as a staff, gave up an average on ground balls last year that was higher than the major league average, despite having Andrelton Simmons there. And then the rest of the infield wasn't bad. So, it's no guarantee that Simmons is really going to help anybody on the Angels staff.
How about Aaron Hicks going to the Yankees for catcher John Ryan Murphy? What do you guys think about that trade?
I mean, it certainly seems to be a coup for the Yankees, although I'm sort of surprised that the takes by a lot of the baseball writers were, kind of all over the map. But,
yeah.
Hicks, I think, has a ton more upside. Could maybe be a regular. There's, Brett Gardner trade rumors right now. As it stands, Hicks would just be sort of the replacement for Chris Young, which is more relevant to daily fantasy than yearly fantasy.
He hit lefties really well, but yeah. there was that month, I think it was August last year, July, somewhere around there.
It was July, yeah.
Yeah, where he just went off and made you think, okay, this guy does have the potential that all the prospect rankings said he had 2 or 3 years ago, and good batting eye. Some power, some speed. I think basically Hicks is aspiring to be what Dexter Fowler was this year. And playing in Yankee Stadium could help him achieve that. So it just depends how much they play him and whether or not he's particularly motivated to achieve those lofty heights, because motivation has apparently been an issue for him all this time.
Yeah, and look, giving up a backup catcher for him was a no-brainer. It's a good deal for the Yankees, I think, almost regardless of what happens. You got to like it. But let's be honest here. The Yankees' three starting outfielders are Brett Gardner, who it was recently revealed he played a lot of last year with a wrist injury, which you can clearly see the numbers were terrible for him after the All-Star break. Gardner, Ellsbury, and Beltran. Hicks is going to play a lot. He's going to be a regular at some point, whether they trade Gardner or not.
Yeah.
And I think it's exciting. Well, I think it was a really good deal for them. And what about John Ryan Murphy? Do you think he could develop into fantasy relevance?
The deep league, and that relies on him playing more than half the time. And some mixed signals there, too, as to what his role is going to be. I think he's actually offensively, probably defensively, too, an upgrade over Kurt Suzuki, but even if the Twins gave him, say, 100 games behind the plate, I'm not sure he'd even be relevant as a number two catcher in mixed leagues.
Now, Yankees have a prospect, Gary Sanchez, that probably should be on people's radars in dynasty formats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And I don't remember if it was Cashman. I think it was Cashman, made the comment that, if something happened to Brian McCann, they have full confidence that Sanchez could step in and be a quality starting catcher.
Oh. He was actually up a little last year at the end, which I didn't remember.
Well, me either.
I think he got like 2 plate appearances or something.
And he's, it's been a while now since this trade happened. I don't know if he slowed down, but he was Well, is the league over? Is the Arizona Fall League, did it end?
I don't think, yeah, I think just a few more days.
But he was kicking butt there. That's usually, usually a player who gets a lot of buzz in the AFL.
Yeah.
Then ends up being one of the most talked about in spring training as well. And a lot of times forces his way onto the roster. With McCann there, I don't see that happening with Gary Sanchez, but I do think it's likely that, you know, we get into post All-Star break. We start seeing McCann at first more or DH more, and Sanchez comes up and is getting 50% of the starts behind the plate. I could see that happening.
So I have this weird off-the-wall prediction that's based on almost nothing that I'd like your opinion on. It's this horrible gut feeling I have. I feel like this is going to be – this year could be the beginning of the end for Brian McCann. I think he's going to get hurt this year, miss some time. It just seems like he's due. He's not the most – he just doesn't look like he's in shape, you know? And he's caught so many innings. And last year he had that foot problem, and then he changed his like orthotics or something, and it seemed to heal. I just kind of feel like the bubble's going to burst on McCann.
I'm not expecting that at all. I was thinking that maybe a couple years ago, actually, when he really had fallen off offensively. But he's rebounded pretty nicely, at least in terms of power.
Or at least leveled off.
Level off, yeah. I mean, he's at an age where a lot of catchers really, even though he's post-peak, in terms of age, 32, I think, next year, a lot of catchers kind of settle into their peak.
Okay.
At that age.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for talking me off the ledge. You know, Leonis Martin used to be fantasy relevant, a guy you probably were starting in roto leagues. He stole over 30 bases two seasons in a row in 2013 and 2014. He is now on the Mariners, who also acquired Joaquin Benoit. Some moving parts here. James Jones going to Texas with Tom Wilhelmson and a player to be named. Okay,
yep.
So, Scott, give me your thoughts on these series of trades for the Mariners.
Well, you kind of glossed over one of the names that I thought was most significant to move, that moved, and that was Tom Wilhelmson, because even after the acquisition of Joaquin Benoit, there were... You know, on a lot of the depth charts, Wilhelmson was showing as the Mariners' closer, which I didn't necessarily believe, but considering he finished last season in the role, you have to give it some credence. Now that he's gone, I would assume it's either going to go to Benoit or even better, Carson Smith, whose ratios, looking back at them, for as non-committal as Lloyd McClendon, who's now gone, by the way, is... As non-committal as he was to Smith last season, Smith's numbers were outstanding. Strikeout rate was, you know, just behind the Kenley Jansens and Craig Kimbrels of the world at 11.8 per nine. His FIP, 2.12, among all pitchers with at least 50 innings, so basically full-time relievers, Carson Smith had the sixth best FIP. So he'd be a potentially elite closer. So that's something to keep an eye on in the months ahead if the Mariners acquire a quote-unquote true closer or if they offer any other insights into where they may be going with the role. As for Martin, I mean, he's young enough to maybe redeem some of the value that he lost last year, but frankly... I haven't seen enough from him to be that interested in him in fantasy, except as a low-end source of steals. And I don't think leaving Texas for Seattle is necessarily going to help on that front, other than the playing time aspect, of course.
All right, Al.
Yeah, well, initially when the Mariners got Benoit, that made me a little bit worried for Carson Smith, and for all the reasons that Scott cited, I think he'd be a terrific fantasy and real world closer. So I think he could be of service to fantasy leaguers as a number one reliever if his new manager puts him in that role.
Well, let's talk about David Ortiz, guys. He's going to be 40 tomorrow. How about that? You better wish him a happy birthday.
Or else what?
Well, I'm not going to wish him a happy birthday, so I won't threaten you.
You can wish him in poll form.
Will David Ortiz have a happy birthday? Yes or no?
Yeah, exactly.
He was the number 18 hitter in points leagues, number 28 hitter in roto leagues. Batting average isn't what it used to be. Now, Is there any reason to doubt David Ortiz going into 2016?
Sure. He's 40.
Yeah, but he was 39 and he was 38. You know, I was like, I'm tired of playing this game.
And I know I am too. No, I mean, we talked about this, Scott and I, a couple weeks ago, because I mean, if you look at the numbers, I mean, those seem to, even as a DH only guy, seem to like maybe put him in the first five rounds. And there's no way I'm doing that. I mean, I think last year he was going, I don't have the ADPs, but it seemed like he was going maybe seventh round.
Mm-hmm.
And there's be no reason to draft him any earlier than he went last year. He's a year older.
In this mock draft I do it with myself, which of course is heavily biased by myself, but he went late round seven.
Late round seven.
That was the earliest.
Who took him?
All 12 Scott.
Who took him?
Yeah. Yep.
You know,
but look, he could deliver top five round production, like Al was saying. It's just because he hasn't fallen off yet doesn't mean it's never going to happen. Well, I guess now that he's announced his retirement in next year, it may never happen. It's not like he has any control over that, really.
He hit 228 in his first 33 games. So if you draft Ortiz and he gets off to a bad start, he has a pretty good track record of bouncing back. Ended up hitting 273. One thing kind of interesting, last year Ortiz struggled a lot against lefties. He slugged nearly 200 points better against righties and lefties. And I thought back to Adrian Gonzalez going into 2015, and I was thinking, well, I don't think the batting average is going to be that good anymore because it seems like he can't hit lefties anymore because he was horrible against lefties in 2014. And then Gonzalez actually had a better batting average in 2015 against lefties than he did against righties. Not a lot of power. I think only four or five home runs, but the batting average was better. So maybe that's a stat that can bounce back. Don't know. And I also think he probably wasn't that bad against lefties after those first 33 games. But
yeah,
is there a way to calculate? Does anybody track that? Splits from in a time range?
A date range? Not that I've been able to find.
Yeah, well, come on. FanGraphs, Baseball
Reference. It would be
reference.
Very handy. There are many times I've wanted.
Right? I mean, it's so obvious, people. Let's get on that. Other signings, other trades, other whatevers, news. Marco Estrada going back to the Blue Jays. Pierzynski back to the Braves. Franklin Gutierrez back to Seattle. And Colby Rasmus, Matt Wieters, and Brett Anderson became the first three players to accept their one-year qualifying offers, which guarantees them over $15 million bucks if they don't land a long-term deal somewhere. So I hope you're happy, Houston. Houston, we have a problem. Is that too obvious?
Yes, but not still not bad.
All right, any cherry pick there? Anything you guys want to talk about?
Well, Marco Estrada. I mean, it's kind of a feel good story that he, you know, gets to go back to the place where he resurrected his career. But I'm still trying to figure out exactly how he did so well there because it looked like a move to Toronto was about the last thing he needed other than maybe a move to Colorado after what happened to him in Milwaukee, giving up all those home runs. But, you know, he's lives and dies by the fly ball, which means that the low whip is pretty legit for him. Not quite as legit as, you know, it was. I think he overperformed in that regard. But, you know, sort of, I view him as sort of a Colby Lewis type in any given season. Could just get destroyed by home runs, especially given the park and the division in which he pitches.
And I know you guys were buzzing about the Jeremy Hellickson trade.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know,
that wasn't buzzing. I was just snoring.
more relevant, I think, is Deonna Navarro a free agent?
Yes.
I believe he was Estrada's personal catcher, wasn't he?
I could check.
Yeah, why don't you check that out?
I don't recall that.
I think he was. If they had a nice little thing going. So, something to keep an eye on. Okay.
Navarro. All right, hang on. I gotta look.
We're gonna end it with, the email of all emails.
That's a great way to end it.
Yeah. And we'll read more emails on our next show in 2 weeks. I don't think I mentioned that. We're not doing a show next week because of Thanksgiving. So in 2 weeks, we'll be back with another episode. All right. We know him, as the other Scott. He is a former podcast leaguer. And a fantasy friend of ours now.
And yeah, I still play in a bunch of leagues with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he draft in your top 300 draft?
No, he didn't. That was only one Scott in that draft.
Okay, here's his email at fantasybaseball@cbsi.com. He says, Dear Daryl, Alex, and Chipper.
Shoot.
First overall picks? Is that? Well, is there more to it than that?
Oh, because, yeah, I was thinking third baseman, and I'm Darrell Evans is the name I was trying to think of.
Oh.
But, no, because this is Darrell with a Y.
Yeah, so like I think strawberry.
You, so you were correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dude, Scott, you're on fire. Okay. Anyway, I've been following with interest the Harper versus Trout debate. You had a feeling. You knew it was going to come back to this, guys, right?
Okay.
My gut tells me Harper is not as safe as his pedigree is being given a little bit, and his pedigree has been given a little bit too much weight. I looked for guys who had previously been drafted number one overall and had at least one full season with an OPS under 900 and then broke out for their first 900 OPS season. I then looked to see if they maintained or regressed the first year after that breakout season. Harper supporters will love the fact that not one guy had an OPS under 800 the following year, unless you count Pat Burrell, which I refuse to do. The Trout supporters will note that only one guy, Adrian Gonzalez, had an OPS of over 900 after the breakout year. The average OPS, excluding Burrell, after the breakout year for this seven-man cohort was 866, which is almost identical to what AJ Pollock did in 2015. Note that Trout has never been under 900 for a full season. I think it was the great Bob Marley who said, "Don't forget your history. Give me Trout. My data is pasted below for your reference." And it's Daryl Strawberry, Chipper Jones. Oh, there we go. There's the answer to his greeting. Daryl Strawberry, Chipper Jones, A-Rod, Griffey, Joe Mauer, Will Clark, Pat Burrell, Adrian Gonzalez, and Justin Upton narrowly missed the list. He had an 899 OPS at age 21 and came back with a 799 OPS the next year. Let's just sum up those findings.
The thing is, it's
hard
for me to equate. This is really cool, and
yeah,
you know, these are all certainly big, top overall guys, so guys with big pedigrees. But you know, Daryl Strawberry, I think sort of a unique case. A-Rod, I would have taken my chances with A-Rod in any year, earlier in his career. Same thing with Griffey Jr. Mauer as a catcher, I think, is a little bit of a different case.
Uh-huh.
So, I don't know. Seeing A-Rod and Griffey in this list.
They all were under 900 except for Adrian Gonzalez.
Yeah, but, I mean,
not
that one season.
you can't. Even if Jones, A-Rod, and Griffey were all under 900, technically, you're talking about three of the best hitters ever.
Oh, so, yeah, I know, but you're also talking about that with Trout.
Yeah. I just don't see how this works against Harper, really. I guess the fact that, Trout's never had an OPS under 900, and these guys technically did. Okay, but that doesn't mean Trout will necessarily. It's not going to take much to make up that difference.
I think you could flip this. Exactly. And that. The lesson here is that, these early draft pick high-caliber players don't always have a linear path to greatness.
You know what? And this is not interesting podcast listening at all.
Oh, okay. Can't wait.
Feel more comfortable with Trout. Take Trout. I mean, it's not like they're both so good. I almost don't care. I might just flip a coin when it comes down to it. If I have the number one overall pick.
But it's got to be a three-sided coin.
I feel like. Well, I guess I'm still on the fence about that. I'm leaning more against Goldschmidt now and him being the clear third.
Wait, what?
But. It may have to be a three-sided coin because one thing I noticed when I did this mock draft with myself, which I'm going to refer to sometimes every podcast for the rest of the off season, is that first base, at least starting out, is not nearly as deep as we're used to it being. It will be a struggle to fill that 11th and 12th for that 11th and 12th team to get a first baseman they feel good about heading into the season. And it may change very quickly because Prince Fielder could suddenly regain it. Somebody like Todd Frazier could gain it, or I'm trying to think of who lost it. First base is probably the easiest position for a player to gain eligibility at over the course of the season. So I still feel pretty confident saying by season's end it'll be as deep as we're used to. But going in, somebody's going to have Mark Teixeira as a starter. Somebody might have Lucas Duda as a starter. And it's just hard to feel good about that. So that helps Goldschmidt's case, long story short.
Okay, well, how dedicated are we? We are here once a week during the off season, except for next week, and we do long drafts with only ourselves and compete against 11 other versions of ourselves, all for you. So I hope you're enjoying it. Scott and Al, you guys have terrific weeks. Happy Thanksgiving, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Same to you. And by the way, Anthony Desclafani is now up to 16%.
Hey, all right.
They were
up.
Listening to this podcast, which isn't being broadcast live.
It's unbelievable that we haven't done a Harper versus Trout poll. That's clearly going to happen in our next show.
Yes, that has to happen.
So just get ready for it. Thanks for listening, everybody. More emails at fantasybaseball@cbsi.com on our next show. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.